We're in Acts chapter 28 this morning, and it's rumored that if you know the name Ernest Shackleton, he's a man of long ago who set out to cross the Antarctic on foot, and he sailed through the Southern Ocean to get there. He took with him a number of people to share in the adventure, and in order to put together his crew, it's rumored that he ran an ad in the London Times. This was in 1914. And the ad said, "Men wanted for hazardous journey, low wages, bitter cold, long hours of complete darkness, safe return doubtful. Honor and recognition in case of success." And that was it. You got to wonder what kind of an effect an ad like that would have upon the general public. This one in particular, Ernest Shackleton himself said that it seemed as if there was no man in Great Britain that didn't want to accompany me on this trip. He got a lot of response. In all, over 5,000 men responded, and according to one source, three sporty girls. So everybody was wanting a piece of this. They all wanted to get on board with Mr. Shackleton. The Apostle Paul never ran such an ad. He never once tried to assemble his own crew or steer his own course in life. He allowed God to do it. He trusted the Lord, unlike so many, that God had the ability to assemble for him the right characters to go along with. He trusted God to direct his affairs in life and to make it count for something by the time the journey was finished. I think the Apostle Paul really exemplified for you and me what it means to have a childlike faith. It was his simple trust in God that made Paul's life worth reading about, which is what we've been doing for, I think, 60-some weeks now. We have been studying the book of Acts, much of which is committed to detailing the events of the Apostle Paul's life. As it turns out, there weren't many, really, who wanted to get on board with Paul. Not even now. Not many people who are willing to take the risk of getting on board with him. Too hazardous. Too hazardous. It's not enough compensation. More uncomfortable than most people would prefer. It's too dark. It's too risky. We come here in chapter 28 to the last chapter of Paul's life, as Luke records it anyway. And it is just as exciting and just as adventurous as it was when it began. The Apostle Paul is a prisoner in transit from Israel to Rome. He's been arrested for causing a stir by serving Jesus. There are no credible charges brought against him, but he's making his way across the Mediterranean Sea with 275 additional passengers to appear in court before Caesar Nero, when suddenly a hurricane caught their ship unaware, and as we pick it up in Acts chapter 28, they have been lost at sea for 2 weeks now, hardly clinging to life, shipwrecked, and now they have just washed up on shore. Now, I ask you before we begin, whoever told you that Christianity was supposed to be boring? And if your Christianity is boring to you and to anybody who you would ever tell it to, it may just be because you're not really on board with the Apostle Paul. You read about it, it's exciting, but to you it's fantasy. God would have it become a reality. God has called all of us to follow along and allow him to direct our course. So we start in verse 1. It says, when they had escaped, and that means escaped the sea and the storm, they've just washed up on shore there, they found out that the island was called Malta. That tells us that they had no idea where they were until somebody told them. The natives showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and made us all welcome because of the rain that was falling and because of the cold. Now, this is in the Mediterranean Sea. The Mediterranean Sea covers some nearly 1 million square miles. That's really big. It's a great big sea with somewhere between 6 and 10,000 islands in it. It's a great big body of water, 6 to 10,000 islands in it. Most of those islands are uninhabitable, okay? Very harsh. But this crew happened to wash up on this one. This is Malta, and Malta isn't that big. This is a 9-mile by 17-mile speck in that sea, and the word Malta means refuge. Just so happens to be an island called Refuge, and a refuge it certainly was. This was an island that, unlike most others in the Mediterranean, was actually inhabited. Not only was it inhabited, but by some of the most unusually hospitable people. Boy, what a place to wash up. Moreover, they originally wanted to get to Phoenix. If you remember, earlier in chapter 27, they were in Fair Havens, and they wanted to get just 40 miles closer to Rome before winter set in, 40 miles by harboring in Phoenix. This puts them actually 500 plus miles closer to Rome. So after all this, it turned out okay. I have to, in my own mind, remind you of the verse here because I recall it so vividly that God uses all things for good. God will use all things for good. And when we hearken back to what Paul has been through, you might have asked yourself in the middle of it all, is God really able to salvage anything out of this? We've lost our lives. Our ship. We've lost our cargo. We've nearly lost our lives. How is God going to make anything out of this? And he does. So they are over, 10, 11, 12 and a half times closer to Rome than they ever thought they would have been at this point. They are accosted by a very hospitable people. The original word is barbaric. When it says natives, it's barbaros. It's where we get the word barbaric. You couldn't have asked for better barbarians to find you there on the shore. Could have been cannibals, but it wasn't. See, God wanted them on this island, Malta. They've got business to attend on this island. Nobody ever would have known it. And had God not interfered like he did and redirected that ship, they never would have done this. And by the time we're all said and done, Paul is going to so minister to these people that church tradition tells us that the one in whose estate they stayed for 3 days, Publius, he is going to convert to Christianity, and he's going to start the first church on the island of Malta. And if you're unaware, this is still an island to this day that is more densely populated than most other places on this planet, including India. And India is quite populated. But per square mile, there's, from what I understand, almost 500,000 people on an island that's 9 miles long and 17 miles wide. And Christianity found them 2,000 years ago. So there they are. God is in direct control of these affairs. In Psalm 107, it says, "Those who go down to the sea in ships see the works of the Lord. For he commands and raises the stormy wind, which lifts up the waves of the sea. They mount up to the heavens, they go down again to the depths. Their souls melt because of trouble. They reel to and fro and stagger like drunken men, and they're at wit's end." This is kind of what we've been reading. "And they cry out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brings them out of their distresses, and then they're glad, and he guides them to their desired haven." So here is Paul and his crew on Malta. But in verse 3, so there's a change of tone here. They made it. Everything's great. But when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. You know, you just thought you made it. You thought, all right, I'm here. And God just kind of heaps more on you. You ever felt like that as you serve the Lord? It's interesting. I've always in my mind had that visual of ants on a sidewalk. You know, in the where the seam of the sidewalk is, ants always build mounds there. You've just seen those before? Little hills of sand. Have you ever been so evil as to like cover them up and like dump the sand, like ruin it? Some of you are shaking your heads. You guys are evil. I've never done it, but I've met people like you, and it's horrible. No, if you've ever done it, you wait for a while, and what happens? Pretty soon, boop, an ant pops out the top, and pretty soon they're back to building. And sometimes, honestly, as I serve the Lord, I've had that feeling before where God is just, the harder I work, the more he dumps on me. And I have to keep rebuilding. I have to keep climbing out the top again. And it can be a little bit daunting to serve the Lord when you know that for all your service, you may or may not get any respite. And Paul, after all of this, he's there on the island, and you think, we survived, and he gets bit by a poisonous snake. Now, before we deal with the snake issue, I want to show you a little detail that's easily overlooked in that verse. You go back to verse 3. Paul was gathering sticks. And that might seem like a trivial little detail to fix our attention to, but I want to because I think it's worth our recollection here that the Apostle Paul is just as battered and bruised as anybody else that was on that ship. He is no less exhausted. He is no less hungry, wore out, cranky than anybody else. And what's he doing? He's still serving. He's not just going to sit there and expect everybody else to gather sticks and make a fire. He's going to pitch in, and he's going to serve with what energy he has left. Now you go, what would possess a person to do that? Generally speaking, most people in a situation like that where they're exhausted, they're just tired, they had enough, would probably just like try and find a place to sit down, maybe take a nap, have a hot cup of tea, try and warm up by the fire that somebody else built. What would drive Paul to continue serving after all of that? Well, he tells us in 1 Corinthians 9:19, he says, though I'm indebted to no one, like I don't have to do this, he says, but I have made myself a slave to everyone, and here's why, to win as many of them to Christ as I possibly can. Why is Paul still serving? Because he wants these people to come to Christ. Hell for them will be far more uncomfortable than a cold, wet night on a island will be for him. And so he's going to help build this fire. In Mark chapter 9, verse 35, Jesus said, whoever wants to be first, this is why Paul is so much spoken of even 2,000 years later, because he's first, he's preeminent among the apostles. How did he get there? By following Jesus' instruction in Mark 9:35, when Jesus said, whoever wants to be first must take last place and be the servant of all. You want to be first? You want to be first? You want to get ahead? You want to be on top? Then go low. Be a servant. Be a slave. Serve everybody. Treat everybody like they're better than you. Serve, 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 and then serve some more. And what an impression the Apostle Paul's attitude and conduct has left upon this world. I mean, the fact that we're still sitting around reading about him and highlighting the fact that this dude was gathering sticks once, you know, he's building a fire. Man, what a guy. What an example to follow. And what does Paul get for all of this? What does he get for all of his humble service? Bit. That's what. He gets bit. How do you like that? When you serve for as many years as Paul had, you are bound to get bit sooner or later. And it probably won't be by a snake. It'll probably be a person. Somebody come along and wound you, deeply wound you, with some unwarranted jab that puts poison in your blood. That's what's going to happen. It won't be a snake. And what they do to you will inflame your emotions. It'll maybe even stop you from serving people ever again. It's not an if on this one, it's a when. I've told people before that you're going to get hurt. And the reason it hurts so badly, and the reason it's so lethal, is because it's not a snake. See, people can more often, I think, survive a snake bite than they can being wounded by somebody else's words or behaviors. And I've seen this oh so often in the church. People get hurt. It fills them up as with venom. The poison of bitterness and animosity sets in, and they can do nothing about it. And oftentimes, they'll quit serving us from that day forward. We never see them again as if they were dead. Now, here's a thought. You remember that there were 276 passengers on that ship. Here on the island, gathering around that fire, are those 276 plus the natives that have come to help them and to show hospitality to this crew. So you've got, I would guess, no less than 300 people, perhaps far more than that, but we'll just say 300 for a nice round number. So of all the 300 people that are there, what are the chances that Paul is the one to get bit by the snake? Come on, it's easy math. 1 in 300, right? I mean, if you told me that this afternoon there was a 1 in 300 chance that I would get bit by a snake, it wouldn't stop me from doing whatever I had planned. 1 in 300, it's probably not going to happen. What if I told you there's a 1 in 300 chance you're going to go out the door and you're going to struck by lightning or hit by a car? Or what? You know, you're not going to hide and, oh no, you don't run and hide on a 1 in 300 chance that something might go wrong. So the chances are very, very slim that Paul's going to be the one, and yet it happened. Paul gets bit by the poisonous snake. Now, who's behind this, spiritually speaking? Some of you, you'd be like, it's the devil. It's Satan. He's trying to kill Paul because he's Paul, and Satan, he sent a snake, sent a poisonous snake. And people get really fanatical when it comes to the devil. I don't know that I would so quickly attribute this to the devil. I would wholeheartedly say, I think God had something to do with it. Did you know that in the Old Testament, there's a very kind of hidden verse, Amos chapter 9, verse 3, that says that God can command a poisonous snake to bite somebody and it will? That God could just do that if he wanted to? And I dare say that perhaps that's what happened in this instance. Now, the big question would be then, if it's God and God commanded the snake to bite Paul and it bit Paul out of all 300 people to bite, then what was God's purpose in it? Why would God do such a thing to Paul? Why would God do such a thing to you? Huh? Why does he let us get bit? Why can't we all just serve each other, get along, gather sticks and warm up by the fire together without the occasional snake bite? Why do we got to endure this? I think God has his reasons. The reason in this case is because it put the Apostle Paul on center stage. All 300 sets of eyes are on him. They're all watching him now, aren't they? Everybody. And out of all 300 or so people, who did God want on center stage? Paul. Not Julius the centurion. Not one of those fickle soldiers that tried to run for their life already. Not any of the other prisoners that were on board. And not any of the natives either. He wanted Paul to command the audience, to secure their attention. Why? Listen to me. Because there ain't hardly a single born-again Christian in that entire group. And God's concerned about their souls, and so God's going to do some saving. And to do that, they first have to do some listening, at least some watching. And there's no one better than the Apostle Paul to listen to and to watch. So, I think God here is just about to reveal his power to these people through an obedient snake. Go bite him! Aye, aye! Well, they can't really do the salute because they don't have hands, but aye, aye! Through an obedient snake and a faithful apostle, that's what he's going to do. So God will show his power. The natives in verse 4 saw the creature hanging from his hand, and they said to each other, uh-oh, no doubt this man is a murderer whom, though he's escaped the sea, yet justice does not allow to live. Justice in their culture was actually a specific deity. It was a god that would have sprung into action in a situation like this if indeed Paul was a murderer, because justice would be served. And they expected this female deity named Justice to, I think her name was Dike, to strike him dead. But Paul shook the creature off into the fire and suffered no harm. Now you talk about, well, geez, Paul, you know, this is all I get for serving you. How did the snake feel? I just did what you told me to do and I'm burning. This sucks. But anyway, that's beside the point. Snakes hardly matter. So he shakes the creature off into the fire and he suffered no harm. However, they were expecting that he would swell up. That means to really catch fire. It speaks of the burning heat with which he would have been consumed if he had indeed been bit by a poisonous snake in that situation. So they expected that to happen because they knew the side effects of a snake bite of that particular kind. They knew what would happen when a person got bit by that snake. They'd probably seen it before. So they were expecting him to burn up with feverish fire or to just suddenly fall down dead. Those were the two options when you get bit by that guy. Okay, those types of snakes. But after they had looked for a long time, they saw no harm come upon him. And so they changed their mind and said he was a god. They went from murderer to god. It's quite a switch, isn't it? A lot of authors I read in studying for this that kind of have a heyday with these guys, they point out how wavering they were in their opinions and how quickly they jumped to a different conclusion, you know. Oh, he's a murderer. Oh, I guess he's god, you know. And I could go down that road and explain how we're all so very, you know, back and forth ourselves. But until you have a discerning mind that has been trained by and in God's word, you're going to do the same thing. I guarantee you, your opinions of people and things are going to jump back and forth like a volleyball over a net. One day you think this, the next day you think that. You need to be grounded in God's word. The truth never changes. It's been the same since it was written, and that's why people say, well, the Bible's archaic. Yeah, it is, and I'm glad that it is because it proves something about it. It doesn't change like everything else does. Good grief. I'm old enough now, at 50 years old, that I have seen our culture shift in seismic ways. Some of you are young. You're in your 20s, and you're like, what do you mean? It's always been like this. Wait till you're 50. If things keep going down this trajectory, you're going to see things so change, it's going to make your hair stand up, make your blood boil. So things change. But the Bible doesn't, and God doesn't. Scripture says that God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. That means he never changes. And so, if we're not grounded in his truth, then we're going to vacillate. So beware of your own tendency to get people wrong. And I say this as an admission that I often do it myself. I can see somebody and form an opinion, which, by the way, we all do. So let's not pretend, you know, whoa, that's wrong. You do it. You know, we all judge each other. We do that. We all stereotype. I'll be the first to admit it. I stereotype. As soon as you walk in, if I've never met you before, I'm already looking and going, and I'm listening to what you're saying. I'm formulating an opinion on you. I have no choice. It's natural, and it's normal, and I think it's healthy, and we all do it. But we have to be careful about it because the opinion we get needs to be well-informed. And sometimes we can jump to premature conclusions like these guys did, really to their own detriment. I mean, if they would have just thrown Paul out as a murderer, they would have missed out on so much. Things like, you know, heaven, eternal life, forgiveness of sins, stuff like that. And so it's good that they have moved off of their former conviction that he's a murderer, but I think they've maybe gone a little too far in claiming that he's now deity, because that ain't true either. But we need to be careful of this. They were very far away from the truth of things. 1 Samuel 16, verse 7 says, people look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And so as we formulate opinions about other people, it's the heart that we need to consider. It's the heart. What's behind the actions that we can see? What's behind the words that we hear them speak? Okay, so as a concession, wait, please, on making any firm judgment about a person until their heart has been revealed. And I'll tell you this, once their heart has been revealed, you are welcome to make a judgment call, and you'd better. Okay? You say, well, it says somewhere in the Bible, thou shalt not judge. Okay, it also says in the Bible, thou shalt judge. Jesus told us to do this in John 7:24. Jesus said, look beneath the surface so that you can judge correctly. See, the other place where it says don't judge, it's talking about premature, faulty judgments. But if you go on to read, even in that same passage, it tells us that we need to be a judgmental people. You can't throw discernment out the window. You can't throw discrimination out the window. And I'm not talking about racial discrimination. I'm talking about spiritual discrimination. Don't be so afraid of the term that you don't know how or where to rightly apply it to your life, or you're bound to get bit by the snake. So, they are coming to premature conclusions about Paul, just as we often do. You need to wait until the heart is revealed. And I'll tell you that it's not serving Jesus or other people that really shows you what's in a person's heart. Because a lot of people will fool you. I've been fooled plenty. People come in and they say the right things and do the right things and they get involved and they serve the Lord, only to 5, 10, 15, 20 years later have their heart totally revealed, and then you realize the truth. So it's not that people serve Jesus or serve each other that shows what's in their heart. It's how they react when they get bit for serving that reveals their heart. Are they going to just throw down their bundle of sticks and die? Never serve again? Not these people. Are they intoxicated by the venom so that they burn up with a feverish frustration and anger toward the people that surround them? Or will they continue to serve through the snake bite? Are you able to serve through the snake bite? Can you keep going? Will you continue to serve the Lord, and will you continue to serve us, even though it sometimes hurts? Now, they're all expecting that Paul's going to burn with fever or fall down dead because they've seen this time and time again. And I can't blame them. I've seen it many times. So that when I watch you get stung or get bit or get offended, you know what I expect? I expect you to leave the church. You know why I expect that? Because I've seen it so many times. People are so thin-skinned, they can't really handle real Christianity. So out the door they go once it becomes a little too real. So I can't blame the islanders for standing around watching Paul, waiting for him to swell up and die. This always happens every time. I've seen people get bit by the snake before, and it always happens the same. So they're all waiting for it to happen, but it doesn't happen because the Apostle Paul is of a different breed. The Apostle Paul is a born-again Christian, and just because he gets bit once or twice doesn't mean he's going to stop serving the people that he loves. And so what does he do? He shakes the creature off into the fire, and he keeps on going. In verse 7, in that region, there was an estate of the leading citizen of the island whose name was Publius. He received us and entertained us courteously for 3 days. Who's us? Listen to me. 276 people. That's who Luke means when he says us. He must have had a big house. I mean, when he received them, he lodged them for 3 days. He entertained them. That means he probably fed them, clothed them, and gave them a place to sleep and rest. This guy was quite the leading citizen. In verse 8, it happened that the father, his dad, was sick. He had a fever. He had dysentery. Paul went into him and prayed, and he laid his hands on him and healed him. And so when this was done, the rest of those on the island who had diseases also came and were healed. This is just really some ministry that the Apostle Paul has got going for himself on the island of Malta. Malta was very populated, by the way. And again, today it's even more so. But there were some Romans on that island because it was governed by Rome. But then there were also the natives. And these are barbarians is what some translations would read. But they were barbaric in speech, mind you. Barbaric refers to the way they talked, not the way they acted. So these aren't, you know, like bone through the nose and like beat people and eat meat, you know, eat the people they beat. These were, because of their language, it simply means foreigner. So they, bar-bar describes their language, barbaric. So bar-bar. If you've ever been to a foreign country whose language you didn't speak, it's gibberish. You know, it might as well be bah, 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 bah. And so that's where the name came from. And so these are foreigners. They back then spoke a, which now is extinct, a language called Punic. It's Carthaginian, or it's a derivative of the Phoenicians, their language. All this to say that it would there would have been a language barrier there between Paul and these natives. Paul couldn't speak their language. They couldn't speak Paul's language. Now, remember, there were Romans on the island who spoke Greek. Paul spoke Greek. And there must have been ability to translate. I'm guessing that Publius, being this leading citizen and as cultured as he seems to be, could have stood in as a makeshift translator for Paul and his crew if communication with the natives was necessary, which I think the Apostle Paul spent the next 3 months attempting in the best way he could to communicate the gospel through any Roman or Greek-speaking person on that island to them and through them to the natives or the barbarians. And so we look at this and we see that there is ministry happening immediately. And it starts with miracles, which I think is interesting because where there's language barriers, God can find a different way to reach people. And here he chooses to do it through miracles. And so Publius's dad was sick with some fever. Multiple commentaries tell me that it was some kind of bacteria that found its way into infected goat milk, and it was unique to that island, and it would result in burning fever and oftentimes death. So this was lethal, okay? Kind of a weird thing. Goat milk, you know, could kill you. Well, it could, and it often did, and so there is this dire situation that the father finds himself in, but Paul goes in and heals him. And when we look at this, and then everybody else from the island comes, and they get healed too. And so this is really just like a scene right out of the Gospels where Jesus would just be accosted by crowds of people with sicknesses and stuff, and he healed them all, the Bible says. And so now Paul gets his turn. And in looking at this, you might, you were, I think, maybe a little tempted to be impressed with Paul's supernatural gift here of healing. But there's something else that's going on, and you wouldn't know it, but it's just as impressive as the ability to heal people from sickness with a magic touch. And that which is equally impressive is humility. Not in Paul, but in Luke. Okay, let's not forget that Luke is there. When he says us, he's including himself. He's the author of this book. And Luke was a trained physician. So he specializes in dealing with sick people. And yet in this situation, he steps aside and allows Paul to do the work. Paul heals these people. Paul gets the glory. Paul gets the credit. And Luke doesn't need any of it. All he wants to do is write this stuff down. He's busy journaling. He's writing a biography. He doesn't need to be a doctor anymore. Paul's doing a fine job. The Apostle Paul is helping people with their illnesses more than Luke ever could have as a doctor. And so him stepping back like this and allowing his colleague to do what Paul did is a remarkable act of meekness and humility. And so here's what I want to get out of this, you guys. I meet Christians all the time who are far more obsessed with spiritual gifting and power than they are with developing meekness and humility in themselves. And I'll tell you which one is far more possible, but far less likely. Meekness and humility. You're probably not going to heal people with a magic touch. If you've ever tried it, you've probably embarrassed yourself. Right? You ever gone to a hospital and just laid hands on people? Oh, Lord, heal! And it doesn't work. But you know what you can do? The Bible commands you to do it. Humble yourself. Humble yourself in the sight of the Lord. That's up to you. See, I think the reason people want miracles and supernatural spiritual gifts and, you know, all this kind of stuff is because it's easy. God does all the work. All I got to do is, you know, quick prayer and then, bing, there you're healed. And then I get all the credit. But humility, oh my goodness, that's hard work. You want humility? You're going to get pounded. And you're going to have to learn to work through snake bites. And you're going to have to learn to continue serving through fatigue. And you're going to have to learn to be a slave, to be last among many rather than first of them all. You're going to have to go low in life and take that low road. And then humility is cultivated in you. And we don't see that as much as we ought to in the church. But I'm glad for one that Luke wasn't so immature. If Luke needed to be the man and he kind of stepped in and, oh, Paul, I got this. I'm a doctor. I got my stethoscope. Step aside. Yeah, he's sick. All right, he's sick. We're going to have to get some medicine. We're going to get a cold washcloth for this man. He didn't. He went, Paul, I know that you can do this and I know that the Lord works through you. So pray for this guy and heal him. I'll write it down. I'll make sure I get every last detail. And so Luke was a very humble individual. In verse 10, it says, they also honored us in many ways. And when we departed, this would be 3 months later, we'll find out in just a second. When we departed, they provided such things as were necessary. So they gave them generous gifts. They gave them lavish honor. I mean, these natives were just really appreciative of the work that they had done on the island for those 3 months. And I don't know, I can't recall off the top of my head whether or not the Apostle Paul ever had a three-month stretch of ministry that was so lopsidedly blessed as this one was. Usually it seems to be kind of mingled with a whole bunch of hardship. But this one, awesome. Awesome. There's no, aside of the snake bite, there's no record of any harassment or opposition, as we have so seen in other cases. No record of persecution from his enemies. No mention of any enemies on that island at all. No mention of oppression or interference of any kind. Just joy, hope, hospitality, physical recuperation, which they all needed, miracles, blessings, appreciation, honor, and generosity. So this is a very unique visit to this island. One commentary says, very rarely in all his years had Paul been so greatly appreciated and sent on his way with his praise on everyone's lips. So this is something different here. And I'll tell you this, some of God's greatest blessings, which I think this might have been in the Apostle Paul's life, one of them anyway, some of the greatest blessings God wants to give to us will come on the heels of some of the hardest trials he will ever allow. And if you don't endure the trials, you will never receive the blessing. That's why James can say, consider it pure joy, brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of any kind. Why? Because you're on the verge of something wonderful, and you have no idea what a blessing it will be. So you hang in there, you endure the trial, you get through it and to the other side, and you will see what Paul saw here. He didn't just drop his sticks and quit serving when he got bit by the snake. He continued to serve and push through it, and now 3 months of wonderful ministry. James says, count it pure joy when you face trials of any kind, because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance. But let endurance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. See, James is pointing ahead to what's on the other side of the trial. So on this side of the trial, we ought to enter into it with a different attitude altogether, one of pure joy. Thank God I'm blasted, tired, freaked out. But praise God, because I only know that his promises are good and that if I hang in there, it'll be awesome one day. I know that. And so endure if you believe it. In verse 11, it says that they spent 3 months there and then sailed in an Alexandrian ship. Now you remember it was the Alexandrian ship that now lay at the bottom of the sea. I don't know if they're looking at Alexandrian ships as a sight for sore eyes anymore. They might be a little bit jaded thinking, no, we're not going to get on that one now. But there's an Alexandrian ship whose figurehead was the twin brothers which had wintered on the island. I was talking about how fortunate, how lucky they were to wash up on that island. It has nothing to do with luck or fortune. They are blessed by God that they were steered right to that island. Not only was it inhabited by some of the most hospitable people they had ever met, not only was it an island called Refuge, not only was it this, that, and the other, it also had many harbors on it, and so it became a port, a commercial hub for ships, big ones, sailing to and fro. And so, after winter was over, there just so happened to be a big enough cargo ship that they could get on that and find their way to Rome. Now, could you imagine washing up on an island and being thankful that God spared you from the sea, only to find out that it's that one island with the single palm tree that you've seen in the Far Side cartoons? And there you are, all 276 of you, and there's just one palm tree and nobody around, and so you're going to die out there. No, this one has lots of people on it and ships to get off the island. So they board this ship, and there they go. Luke mentions that there is a figurehead on the ship. It's a carving on the bow up at the front, and he says that that carving was of Castor and Pollux. It's the twin brothers, Castor and Pollux, if you do some research. But there's a carving of that. These are twin half-brothers, same mother, different fathers, I think. And they were, according to Greek mythology, the gods of navigation. So it made sense, I guess, if you're a pagan, to put that on the bow of the ship, because it would hopefully give you safe travels. But anyway, they were false gods. And we know, as Christians, that false gods of such nature are fashioned after demons, because demons so deceive people into thinking that they are deserving of worship that they can convince people to carve crude things out of wood and mount them on their ships for silly reasons. But Paul, it's interesting, because Paul was a Christian, Luke was a Christian, and Aristarchus is with them. He's a Christian. So you got these three Christians boarding this ship with these, like, idols on it, right? And yet, I just think it's interesting that Luke put this in here. Why did he do that? Well, I don't know, but I'll tell you this. There is no sign of apprehension by any of those three Christians about boarding that ship whatsoever. They just get on there, no problem. Because they knew that their fate wasn't decided by some pagan ship that they rode on. Their fate was determined by the sovereign God that they served. I think there are some Christians that have a very weak conscience, and they wouldn't let themselves get on that ship because it has a weird idol on it. Why so spooked? Why? Do you think they're going to get you? I mean, why is it that we have such a sensitive conscience to things that don't deserve our sensitivity of conscience? And yet so often our consciences are seared to the Holy Spirit, who's trying to get us to give our attention to other things than, like, silly idols that don't mean anything. And yet we don't listen to him. Our conscience is insensitive toward God and too sensitive to the things of this world. And Paul and his friends were in the world, yes, but not of the world. They can ride that ship, but they don't need to worship the gods on the front. So all is well. And did you know this? That a carved idol has no more power and influence in your life to make you evil than any Judeo-Christian relic does to make you holy. So it don't matter if you have a Buddha statue or a cross of Christ. Neither one of those plaster, metal, wooden things does anything for you. You think a cross does anything to make you holy? A little statue of Jesus or a Star of David necklace or a Christian t-shirt or a stupid bumper sticker? You think that that does anything to make you holy? It doesn't. No more and no less than any stupid idol of Castor and Pollux is going to do to make you evil. The Apostle Paul knew this very well himself. In 1 Corinthians 8:4, he says, "We all know that an idol is nothing." Idols that have been fashioned by demons and idols that have been fashioned by Christians and for sale in merchant shops everywhere and crosses with Christ on them. I actually got in trouble for saying that one time at one of the biggest sort of Christian meccas in our country, St. Augustine, Florida. They say that that's the birthplace of Christianity in America because they had the first Catholic mass there. And so, of course, they've got these grounds and a gift shop and a house of prayer, and it's very, very Catholic. And I used to be the groundskeeper, 17 acres. I cut the lawn and rake the leaves and swept the floor of the gift shop. And of course, in the gift shop, there's all this merchandise for sale, all just crosses and Mary and Jesus and every saint you could think of. And none of it bothered me so much as the Jesuses. My conscience was offended that we have turned Christ into a plastic figurine for $5.99 a piece. And I said so. and I got pulled into the office. somebody told on me, and I had to go answer for it. But I'm telling you that the Apostle Paul knew that plastic was plastic and wood was wood, no matter what shape it took, and it had no bearing on your Christian maturity or lack thereof. So if you want to be a dynamic Christian, don't worry about the stuff you have or the world you live in. Be concerned about the things you think and the actions you take. Surrender your life to Christ and don't worry about your Christian t-shirt. Now, I don't care if you wear a Christian t-shirt or not, but if you're not surrendered to the Lord, you have no business wearing it anyway. In verse 12, they landed at Syracuse. They stayed there 3 days. From there, Luke says, we circled around and reached Regium. And after one day, the south wind blew. And the next day, we came to Puteoli. And then we found brethren, that would be Christians. And we were invited to stay with them for 7 days. And so we went toward Rome. If you noticed, it says that the south wind blew. Did you get that? The south wind blew. We've heard that before. But the last time that we heard that was in chapter 27. The last time the south wind blew, it provided them with a false sense of security. They assumed that they were doing the right thing when it was in fact the wrong thing. They had rejected godly counsel, if you remember, and the south wind gave them the impression that they were actually going in the right direction, which they weren't. This time, it's different. Same south wind, but they're in the will of God this time. What's the difference? One commentary asks the question, what's the difference between the two south winds? Well, one of them led them in the direction of God's will, the other one took them away from it. It says, when we're discerning God's will, we need to be sure that our voyage lines up with the Word of God, the Spirit of God, and the counsel that God provides, lest we end up a veritable shipwreck. South wind is neither here nor there. Sometimes a gentle breeze will blow you into disaster. So don't look at your circumstances and think, well, I guess this is God's will because it's wonderful and pleasant and it's what I want. Verse 15, from there, when the brethren heard about us, these would be the Christians in Rome, they started out and came to meet us as far as Appii Forum and Three Inns. When Paul saw them, he thanked God and took courage. So now they have landed at Puteoli, and that would have been right close to where the Appian Highway ran. It was really state-of-the-art highway system that went through Italy and through Rome and many travelers. So they found that. Now, their whole motley crew is walking that road. You've got criminals there. You've got soldiers there. You've got a few Christians. And as they're getting nearer to Rome, they're greeted by this undisclosed number of Christians. It had to be a good number of them that are coming down from Rome. They've walked 43 miles. That's the distance between Rome to the Appii Forum. And then 10 miles later, as they go on, there's three taverns. That would have been 33 miles from Rome. And so that's just a seedy stop through. It's a not too Christian place to stay if you wanted to stay. And so their group keeps getting bigger and bigger the closer they go to Rome. And so here they come. And you got to wonder, you remember Julius? He's the centurion that's been kind of in charge of Paul the whole way through. You got to wonder what he's thinking in this trip. And now as they get closer to Rome, here's this mob of strangers, and they don't even know Paul, half of them. And they're like, hey, Paul! And Julius is watching this going, who are these Christians? They just love each other even though they don't know each other. And then 10 miles later, oh, he's a bunch of great Paul, Luke, you know? And it's like, if I'm Julius, I'm going, what the heck's up with these people? One commentary says, there's been no Caesar who ever had a warmer reception on his way to Rome than this unsung Jewish missionary. And so Julius, the centurion, is watching this going, man. Because there's Paul in chains, right? So he's in cuffs. He's accompanied by guards. He's flanked by criminals. He's on his way to court, and he's receiving a hero's welcome. And Julius has got to be going, what the heck is this? And the other soldiers, these guys that worked for the Roman government, they got to be like baffled at how Christians act in times of crisis as they've watched Paul do and respond to one another, even though they're strangers as Christians often will. And the hospitality that they show and all this, no Roman centurion before or since had the opportunity to march in a parade like this one. And so there's Julius, just kind of caught up in the action. But then there, at this point, it's time to say goodbye. And I have no idea what the goodbye was like between Julius the centurion and his newfound friend, the Apostle Paul. I won't know till heaven, but I bet Julius will be there. I'm banking on it. And I'd love to watch a video of that one. I wouldn't be surprised if this tough Roman centurion actually shed a tear as he said goodbye to Paul, knowing that Paul could very well be executed after this. I think Paul was near and dear to his heart. Nevertheless, they said goodbye. He had to pass him off to a different soldier to guard him. In verse 16, it says, "When we came to Rome, the centurion delivered the prisoners to the captain of the guard, but Paul was permitted to dwell by himself with the soldier who guarded him." He would have been chained to this soldier. What an end, at least to this section of the story, and we're nearing the end of the whole account. But nobody, when they left Caesarea on the ship, nobody who got aboard that ship knew what they were headed into. And yet for the next, 6 months or so, as they endured the hurricane and survived on that island, there were a couple hundred unnamed travelers who got swept up in the current of God's great plan on earth through the Apostle Paul. Nobody on that ship, though they depart here in verse 16, nobody walked away the same. They had seen things that they could never forget. They had been through things that were too much to ignore. They had met a man and even a couple others whose message was loud and clear. And they all know, as they go into different directions from that point, they all know enough to be saved or damned. And they all have to make a decision on what to do from that day forward. Paul has left them a stark example to follow. Will they love and serve Paul's God, or will they go back to their old life, their old crime, their old idols? It's decision time for them. But they had been through a lot. God himself had put them through enough to open their eyes to a new offer on life. It was, for them, a harrowing, death-defying, gut-wrenching experience that, quite frankly, very few people will ever sign up for. Very few people. If you read an ad in the paper today that said, "Men wanted for hazardous journey, low wages, bitter cold, long hours of complete darkness, safe return doubtful, but honor and recognition in case of success," would you answer that ad? Would you be one of those men or those few sporty women who had the courage to sign up for something that you had no idea what would happen along the way? Because I'll tell you this, most people will forego the intensity that the true Christian life offers, and they will instead settle for an average life. But if you do that, that does not make the ad go away. The ad is still being run to this day. Men and women are still answering that call, regardless of whether you do or not. God still wants men and women for a hazardous journey. It's exactly what Jesus meant when he said, "Come and follow me." The call goes out. The ad has been published. You get to decide.